The good physician takes care of the disease, and the great physician takes care of the patient.
This is episode 376 on the Hidden Why podcast with Jessica Zitter. G'day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the show. My name's Lee Manuzzi. Great to have you here with me today. I'm looking forward to sharing this interview with you. First of all, guys, here at the Hidden Why, I'm all about inspiring others to live life with greater passion and purpose. And to do that, it's really about connecting within, using what you know to navigate your life on the path, on the journey of life that you truly wish to live. And hopefully living in doing so, living with greater passion, purpose, freedom, fulfillment, and happiness. Guys, today's guest is Jessica Zitter. She's an MD. She practices ICU and palliative care at the County Hospital in Oakland, California. And basically her story is about, you know, the transition from going from very much a medical practitioner to a person that was more patient-centric to help remove the suffering from those people that were on their last days or on their path to the end of life. She has recently written a book called Extreme Measures, which is finding a better path to the end of life. And that is what sparked my interest in Jessica and urged me to get her on the show here and talk to her more about that. And certainly it was a conversation that I was a little bit underprepared for, but I believe I asked some good questions and got some good value into, you know, what it's all about and what this transition all means and how we can make that last part of our journey perhaps more pleasurable or more enjoyable or, more importantly, less sufferable. So I talked to Jessica about that and her experiences there and certainly asked some insightful questions there. Now, probably what I got about out of this conversation was, you know, around having those difficult conversations. And we talk about that, you know, the communication, having tough conversations and what we can do to assist there. She's got a great acronym that she shares there as well. It's a really interesting conversation, unique to the Hidden Wire podcast, I would suggest, but certainly one that will give you a lot of value. So hopefully you guys get something out of it. I would love to hear from you if you do. You can reach me at thehiddenwhyguy@gmail.com with any of your questions or feedback for the show, this episode or others. And you can also connect with me at Facebook and Twitter and leave your comments in the show notes at episode 376 at thehiddenwhy.com. Reach out to Jessica, guys. Thank her for coming on the show. If you're interested in her field of work and what she's doing, you can also grab a copy of her book. I will stick the link in the show notes, the Amazon link. So if you want to support the show, that is one way you can do that just by using that Amazon link there as well. Other than that, guys, have a good day. I hope you enjoy this show and we will speak at the other end. Thank you. G'day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Hidden Why podcast. Lee Manuzzi here and I am joined with Jessica Zitter. Jessica, how are you today?
Very well. Thank you so much.
I just heard you've got a cup of Earl Grey there with you, but I believe it's probably the afternoon or coming into the evening for you.
It's about noon, actually.
Oh, is it noon? There you go.
Yeah.
Have you had your lunch yet?
No, but I'm actually not hungry, so I think I'm doing okay for now.
Okay. No worries at all. Well, look, thank you, Jessica, for taking the time out to join us on the podcast. I look forward to speaking to you and certainly about your book. You've got a new book out, which is called Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life. Now, that title struck me because really the essence of the show here is all about creating a better path in life so that we can live it fully and not get to the end with any regret. But I know you go a lot deeper than that. I'm very excited about chatting about your book. So tell us, Jessica, what brought on the creation of the book? Why did you decide to write this book?
Well, I went into medicine because it was sort of a family business. Everybody in my family for the previous two generations was a doctor. I'm exaggerating, but a lot of doctors. And we kind of, as a family, we saw medicine as sort of the pinnacle of heroism and of caring and compassion and of justice and all of these things, and had a lot of ideas about it. And I went into medicine and I went into this very heroic, as I saw it, subspecialty of intensive care medicine. And I really thought that, you know, I was going to be able to help, to bring justice, to take care of the rich, the poor, the black, the white, everybody. And, you know, I thought that the currency of doing that, of demonstrating that I was actually doing that effectively, was to save lives. And so I kind of went into this full court press. And very soon and quickly, you know, as I look back at it while I've been writing this book, I really started to experience a lot of moral distress. I didn't really for it at the time, because it was all that I knew how to do. It was just this kind of push, prolong life, add in technology, go, you know, keep going as every organ starts to shut down.
So that's but just I was keeping people alive.
Right. And so, you know, I started to notice that we were doing this again subconsciously on patients who really were pretty much dead, and it just was feeling awful. It felt illogical. It felt kind of cruel, even though we were doing it to be kind. And I was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time about 10 years into my career as a doctor, where they were in the very early stages of establishing a palliative care group. It was official before palliative care even existed officially, and I was basically kicked into shape by a nurse who would just tell me that I needed to be more patient-centered, and I eventually started to listen to her. And so the writing and the stories really come from bearing witness to this, you know, personal transition. This as I went from being this one type of doctor with this within this one paradigm of what it meant to be a doctor to a completely different paradigm. And I wrote to process and to also to show people how we can do it differently.
Okay, that's interesting. So it was really a personal transformation that sort of it sparked the interest to writing the book and sharing that journey. That's really cool. What I mean, I'm sure you've got plenty of insights from that transition, but what are a couple of the highlights that stand out for you from going from that, you know, medicine sort of centric to patient centric sort of approach to palliative care?
Well, I mean, I think the most powerful and obvious one was just that I started to feel better. Even though in some ways it was harder to do what I then started to do, which was to really address each person, as a unique individual, and to take the time out to really talk with them and communicate bad news and figure out who this particular person was and what was important to this particular person and help that family marry that personal piece into the healthcare plan instead of just doing things by default. It's harder. It's psychologically more challenging. It's physically more challenging. And yet I feel better.
Yeah, that's interesting. So what just talk to us about the moral sort of dilemma that you faced there from that transition. What was it exactly that was, because that's obviously where you weren't feeling so great about what you were doing. Talk to us a little bit about that.
You mean specifically the moral distress that I was experiencing
before you made the transition?
I mean, it's just, to be in a room filled with sort of high octane activity and to actually even be driving a lot of that activity yourself, when, again, in retrospect, you realize that you knew the person was never going to benefit from it, it doesn't really work for the human brain. I mean, you're doing this illogical thing that's not going to work, and yet you're just doing it by rote. And I think that doesn't, you know, sit well.
So does it feel sort of unethical?
You know, I wouldn't call it unethical, because I really truly believe that and I think most of the people that I have worked with and trained with went into this wanting to do good. And I can't call it unethical for that reason.
Yeah.
But it is certainly illogical. And it's, I would say there's an inhumanity to it. Again, not a malicious inhumanity, but a taking away of the person and the spirit, both of the practitioner and of the patient, that in that process that just doesn't feel good.
Okay. Wow. I assume you're not alone with that sort of feeling that you get in that industry. Certainly I had a grandmother who recently passed away, and I saw her going into a nursing home, and it was just sort of sad to see her there sometimes. But at the same time, what do you do? I don't know. I don't know the answer, but, you know, she seemed to still have a brain and be active, but, you know, it was very, very hard to watch her in that position and leave life in that way.
Right. And, you know, that's a whole different sort of ethical issue of what do you do when someone is just staying alive past a point that they may have wanted to live. And, you know, as a physician, I am not comfortable with the idea of hastening death or of, you know, of doing something on that level. But I certainly am comfortable with the idea of not defaulting to this, what I call end of life conveyor belt, where we just automatically ramp up, you know, treatment and technology without even asking the person. That would be, if her values and preferences were that she would not have wanted to live that way at that point, then the idea that we would actually put her through the throes of these incredible resuscitations just does not feel right to me.
No. Okay. Yeah. Against their will. Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So tell us about what you do now and how you are creating a better path to the end of the life. I mean, you talk about a curriculum that you'd like to create for hospitals and other people to use as well. Talk to us a little bit more about that.
Well, you know, I sort of look at this issue a little bit. I think we need a major cultural shift. And this is not only medical culture, it's lay and sort of regular human societal culture. We've got to start doing this differently. There is so much suffering. I actually call it a public health crisis. The way people die, certainly in America, for the most part, is really just highly causing of suffering. And so I really think that we need to educate the public, and there's this incredible discrepancy between what the healthcare providers caring for patients know about what's going to happen to a particular patient and then what the patient and the family knows. The amount of shock and lack of knowledge of where things are going is so shocking to me all the time. You can see it both in research papers and just on day-to-day interactions with patients, that I see that as an issue of justice. Like, I really think that we've got to be more distributing of this information so that patients and their families have access to the same information that we doctors and patients and nurses have access to.
Absolutely.
So that, you know, that's one piece of this, which is educating and motivating people who are consumers of healthcare to get more of what they need and not to necessarily get what's given to them. And the second part of this is to really help my colleagues, my people in the healthcare team to go through the epiphany that I went through, not because I'm so great, but just because I had this fantastic experience, total coincidence of this nurse who really just kind of knocked me over the head repeatedly. Her name was Pat, and I'm still friends with her, and I see her as the nurse who made me into the doctor I want to be. You know, I really want to help people have the experience that I got by brute force a little more easily, honestly.
Okay. So that, just talk to us about the suffering piece there. What are you talking about when you're saying people are, you know, obviously when you're dying and on the way out, I mean, I assume it's not going to be very pleasant anyway. But what specifically stands out to you as far as the suffering piece there? Talk to us, yeah, just explain that a little bit more.
Yeah. You know, death is, there's no escaping the fact that for many of us, death is sad. And in addition, I think there's no escaping the fact that sometimes deaths, even when there's high attention to, you know, managing suffering and managing pain and managing distress, you know, using, for example, palliative care support, it can be a really difficult time of a person's life. But what really is striking is how you can ramp up suffering by putting machines into bodies, throwing, you know, tubes into very intimate places in your chest cavity and your, right. There's all sorts of tubes that we can apply. And we do it without really talking about it, with this implication that, well, that's the next thing we must do, instead of really sitting and having this very personalized assessment of what this person would want.
Okay. So it's about sort of going out with a bit more grace with the process.
Yeah, taking away the extra element. What I'm advocating for is to remove this extra element of added suffering that we have been giving to patients. And by the way, I want to clarify, I'm not saying that it's wrong to die on a machine. I'm not saying that it's wrong to use machines, even in terminally ill patients, yeah. at all. Mm. What I am saying is that we do it without asking. And that, I think, is not the right thing to do. Because what we know from much data is that when patients actually do have access to information and conversations with physicians about prognosis and end-of-life decision-making, they tend to choose a much lower level of technological intervention than those who don't have those conversations. So that's a very okay. important piece of information.
So it's not so much about removing the process necessarily. It's just about having more information there to remove the suffering of the process.
Yeah, it's about allowing people to opt out of that process if they choose. Yeah, because okay. right now it's a default.
Okay, so we just, if you're on the way, you just get plugged into machines and not really given much information and knowledge about what's going on and sort of just have to accept it.
Right.
Okay. So how to talk to us a little bit about, you know, the people in those situations and in your experience, how have you gone about, you know, dealing with them? Because I assume that's quite a difficult situation to be in. And then to go and explain, you know, and talk about death so openly and explain procedure and process and stuff like that. I assume that's very difficult to do. How do you go about doing that and what's the approach?
Well, you know, it's really, really hard to have any kind of conversation that's, you know, difficult conversations are difficult for human beings. Absolutely. I mean, we avoid all class of difficult conversations, whether about personal relationships or about however you name it, we can avoid it. And that really goes for the ultimate, you know, end, which is death. Yeah. We are very, very, very good, not only doctors, not only nurses, but patients and their families as well, at figuring out ways to avoid that conversation. And so in a way, I see the majority of this responsibility really lying on the healthcare professionals. But I also see a part of this responsibility for enhancing that communication lying in the lay community as well. But what I think we need, for example, doctors who are currently the charged individuals charged with breaking bad news. I don't know that that's the way it should be, mind you, but it is the way it is now. So we need to learn new skills that we are not taught in medical school at this point, new muscle memory, new phrases that we can pull out of our pocket, the same way that I learned protocols when someone went into cardiac arrest. There's ways to practice communication skills that will make it easier for you to get through these very, very difficult conversations, but essential conversations. If you have a phrase that you remember, oh, okay, I'll use one of the nurse skills that I learned. And so there's a place called Vital Talk. It's a group of people who teach physicians and nurses and other healthcare professionals how to have these very difficult conversations. And we do drills. It's like sitting in the hot seat. We go round and round the room and everybody has to literally get muscle memory and phrase memory so that you just can do it more easily.
Do it more automatically. So talk to us about some of that communication. Like what are some of the techniques that you use to open up that dialogue and have that communication in such difficult situations? Because I assume that could be applied to many aspects of our life, you know, to have those tough conversations. What are some of the key techniques?
Absolutely. It's a great question. And actually, it's fresh in my mind because I'm teaching the Vital Talk curriculum to our medical residents at our hospital. So I just was doing this past week. But I'd say one of the most important things and probably one of the best tools that you can put in your pocket is dealing with people's emotion, because as you can imagine, we all hate, you know, number one, breaking news in the first place, which is really the first skill we need to learn. But once that news is broken and we've gotten ourselves to say some difficult words, and maybe that include death or dying, you're going to be probably hit with some kind of an onslaught of emotion, whether it's anger, grief, somebody breaking into tears. There's a lot of stuff, which is why we avoid these conversations in the first place, that's going to confront you. And the thing that you need to learn how to do to stand still in the face of any of those types of emotions, because they're going to come and you're going to need to figure out how to move with that or that family member to stay in place and allow that emotion to pass over so that you can continue the chipping away at the process and eventually coming up with a plan that's going to work best for that patient or family.
Okay. So with that emotion that's released in the moment, it's best to obviously let it flow and let it come out, but sort of just not intervene the flow of that emotion. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think it's several things. I have to admit, I don't always do these well. It's a constant learning process.
It's a constant learning process. Breaks down in front of me, you know, in tears or some sort of emotional outburst, and you know, I sometimes react poorly. It's hard to you know, respond appropriately because it brings your emotions on as well.
Absolutely. So what I would say is it's a combination of not talking too much. Because we fill space, and doctors are particularly bad at it. You know, there are studies that show how much time doctors spend talking and how much time patients spend talking, and it's a really big problem. Doctors, and in one study, talked for about 11 minutes of the 15 minutes, and the patients spoke for 4. You know, it's really important that we give space to the patient to talk and to process and to let their emotions come out and to let their questions start to come out and to just also to show that we can stand with them, that we're not going to run away. That silence, that presence, that stability, that's really, really important. I think the other
silence is one of the hardest pieces about conversation in general, you know, just to those moments where things are silent and in, not even in tough conversations, you know, when you're driving with your husband or wife and there's just that moment like you feel like you should be saying something, but sometimes it's not the case. You should just be, you know, allowing that silence to exist.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. I think it's very therapeutic. And you know, there's a, in this particular course called Vital Talk, there's a set of, it's an acronym called NURSE. Mm. And it's a set of skills that you can, it's a set of phrases that you can use. N is naming the emotion. I can see that you're feeling anxious. You know, U is understanding. I can understand how you must be feeling anxious right now. I can understand why you must be angry at your husband right now. You know, R is respect. We use a lot of respect statements. You have been doing everything that you can to fight this disease. You've tried everything, or you've been doing such an amazing job caring for your mother. A support statement, that's the S. It's pretty obvious, supporting the person. And E is empathy. It's expressing empathy and alignment. So these are things that we practice with our students over and over and over again.
That's
so
a really cool acronym, by the way.
Yeah, it's really great. It's really great.
I like that. And you could use that, as we've been saying, for any situation where someone's, you know, got some high emotion and how to respond and, you know, help them deal with that emotion. Mm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So around, you know, the whole piece of death, certainly with the patients that are experiencing that or going into that sort of situation or chapter in their life, certainly communication is a strong point. What can we do prior to that? I mean, obviously, death is something that, you know, I don't believe any of us want. I want to live forever myself. But, you know, it's something that we don't talk about as a society much, that's for sure. And perhaps it should be something we talk more about. What is your sort of thoughts there as far as it matters to what you do in your job?
You know, I mean, I think it's so much of the problem is really descends from the fact that we want to deny that death is actually reality. It's actually going to happen. We want to avoid it. We don't want to upset our friends and our family. We don't want to bring this in. It's not polite. And so what happens when that is the reality is that we just keep deferring the conversation even as we get sicker or as our loved one gets sicker. And then we end up in extremis, in a situation where you're in the ICU, which is where I work, where all of a sudden it's too late to have had this conversation. It's too late to understand whether or not someone would have wanted to have been heroically kept alive no matter what their quality of life would be. And, you know, then we've missed all these opportunities. And I think what I find in terms of, you know, who are the families that seem to do well in terms of the process of making decisions and who are the families that seem to have much more challenge, it's those families that have actually talked about this stuff before and, you know, have had years worth of conversations where they know, well, what did mom feel about Aunt Irma's death and the fact that Aunt Irma was in the hospital for 3 days. We talked about that. And she told me, you know, I don't want a feeding tube. If I can't taste food anymore, it's not something I want. Or if my brain isn't working and I'm demented, please don't put a feeding tube in me like they did to Aunt Irma. These are the conversations that basically arm us with that information that's so critically important.
Okay. So just to clarify, if you've been, you know, diagnosed with some sort of terminal illness and put into care, if there is no intervention by family members, you just get the treatment to keep you alive as best as possible?
Yes, generally that's the way it has been. You know, some hospitals are just, you know, really starting, and some have had for longer, to have policies that are, you know, futile treatment or non-beneficial treatment policies, where they, you know, if they have a patient who has no representation and yet they really feel that they're doing things and that are not ultimately going to be of benefit or of a quality of life that a general person or would accept, then they can, you know, bring in strategies to say we're going to take a more of a comfort approach, you know, so that is happening more frequently. And of course, sometimes there are situations that happen in hospitals where you've got a family member who's making decisions for a patient that the doctors, the healthcare team really don't believe is in the patient's best interest for whatever reason. There are many different kinds of reasons that you might suspect that. And those kind of cases, sometimes we have to take them to an ethics committee and start to look at all of the evidence about whether or not this person is really, you know, the best person to speak for this patient, and start to evaluate that. I mean, it's complicated, but for the vast majority of patients and their families, you know, you can usually, even if those conversations haven't been had, you can kind of come up with some kind of a plan that people think is probably what would feel best for that patient.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the problem is, I'll tell you, the suffering, the surrogates who have to make those decisions, it's very, very hard on them if they haven't actually heard directly from that patient at one point when the patient was able to speak for himself, this would not be acceptable to me, or this would be acceptable to me. And
yeah,
it's just much weightier.
Hands, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's probably another arm of, you know, how you guys deal with, you know, the actual patient that's dying is dealing with the family members and having those conversations as well. I assume all the conversations in that sort of an environment are very tough to have, and certainly if you're going to ethic committees, that'd be highly intensive as well, based on the emotion that's present there. So what do you guys do to, or is there anything that you guys do to help that pre-conversation to occur?
These are such well-planted questions. Yes, there are. I mean, for example, when we have patients who have serious illness, and we're doing what we call advanced goals of care setting. So, you know, patients really, really sick. This case has gone on for a long time. There's a lot of conflict and stress and acuity to sort of having to make decisions. You know, the things that we try to do in terms of in an ideal hospital setting and a ideal, you know, situation, we would do the following. We would really evaluate the case really carefully. We would come up with a real sense of how everybody felt about the prognosis for this patient and what were the likely outcomes. And people would be on the same page about that, because, you know, it's one thing if one team thinks this is going to happen, but then the cardiology attending comes in and says, oh, well, we, you know, and brings out a completely different prognosis. That can be very confusing for families. So it really is important for us to do our homework and to really get everyone's opinion on the medical team about where things are going prognostically. And then to really sit down with that family and make sure that news is given to the family, number one. And number two, that we're mapping out with that family who they are, who that patient is, what's important, what were that patient's values and preferences. Again, this is if we can't speak with the patient, him or herself. And then that we can ultimately kind of come together with managing emotion all along the way, as I described to you, and come out with a plan that really is going to hopefully bring the patient what the patient would have wanted. But there's a lot more stress involved when these kinds of conversations have never been had, and family members are trying to make them without the input of the patient at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I mean, it sounds pretty deep. I assume you cover a lot of this in your book, the insights into, you know, making that transition better. Is that correct? Is that sort of the gist of the book?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the book is very story-driven. It's very narrative-based, and it tells lots of different kinds of stories of lots of different kinds of patients and their families, and just shows the reader how it can go and all the different ways that it can go. And I think through that narrative can be very educational. But, at the end of the book, there's a very hopefully robust appendix that I think can really take the reader through several steps towards really getting yourself prepared to navigate this territory yourself.
Mm. What I'm interested, you know, when you get notified that you're going to die, I couldn't imagine wanting to stay alive if I had some sort of illness that required me to stay alive on a machine. Is it quite common for people to say, yeah, no, I'm happy to keep going and living like this, even though they might be bed stricken and all that?
Well, it's very personal. You know, in my experience, when patients and families get the truth that doctors and the healthcare team are thinking, or they really understand not only when the patient is likely to die, but also very important, and this is very hard. It's a hard thing to bring this information forward, but the benefits and the burdens of the various ways that this person could die. For example, if someone is going to get a trach, which is a more permanent connection, surgical connection to a breathing tube. So instead of just having the tube go through their mouth, it goes into their neck and is attached surgically. And, you know, then they will have to go to a ventilator facility where many people with this kind of serious illness and terminal illness will end up dying on these machines in a ventilator facility. That usually entails, you know, again, with a very debilitated patient, their arms often needing to be tied down to the bed because otherwise they'll pull these tubes out. It includes, you know, many times people getting a variety of infections that end up bringing them back into the intensive care unit in shock. It includes, quite frankly, families not necessarily being able to keep up the vigil of being at the bedside, because it can get very, very exhausting for families as well. Mm. And people don't necessarily know that information. And in my experience, when people do get that information, they are much less likely to want to choose that path. Although I have met some who do for a variety of different reasons, and I respect
it's
that.
It's a lot of personal choice, but okay. No, that makes sense. So having that information is obviously critical to making more insufferable decisions.
Right. And I want to say one thing about that. You know, when I just gave you that description of all the downsides, the very likely and potential downsides of going that route of what I call, you know, the end of life conveyor belt, where you're adding and adding and adding machinery, you know, that is very, very hard. I think people don't understand this. That is very, very hard information to transfer to a patient and family. Why? Because I'll tell you what, you feel like a jerk. You feel like a jerk saying that. Here's this family suffering. You're trying to help them.
Yeah.
And they're hoping and they're wanting any lifeline, anything. And then you say to them, well, then this can happen and then that can happen. And this is what this will look like. And
right.
It feels harsh. Yeah. It feels really harsh. Yeah. And so it's not a common thing for a doctor to want not only to give the prognosis and say, you know, I think we only have this much time, but then to actually go into the description of what this choice will look like versus that choice. It feels harsh. It feels mean. It feels unsupportive. And no doctor really wants to feel that way, because we care.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we're not, it's a really tough position for all of us. And then the patients often end up not knowing. And I wanted to say, there was this crazy study that I saw that even shocked me about looking at the questioning and surveying the loved ones of people who were about to get a trach, this thing that I just described to you, which this permanent, you know, attachment to the ventilator. And they questioned the physicians of those patients and then the loved ones of those patients. And they looked at the difference in what these two groups of people expected would happen to those patients within 1 year. The loved ones thought that these patients were going to do quite well. 94% of them thought that they would be alive. I think 74% of them thought that they would actually be living independently. And I think 84% thought they'd have a good quality of life. And when the doctors of these patients were questioned, the discrepancy was so chilling to look at on a graph. The doctors thought only 40% of them thought the patient would be alive compared to 93%, I think it was. I think 4% of them thought they would be living independently compared to like 74. Yeah. And then 6% of the doctors thought that they would actually have a good quality of life compared to 84. These numbers are telling a very, very important story here. Yeah.
Absolutely. Amazing stuff. I'm interested also in regards to, you know, dealing with patients of that situation in life. What are some of, and I don't know if you can share any of this, but, or even are aware, but I assume you might be. What are some of the, the regrets or perspectives that people have at that point of their life about the life that they lived?
It's interesting because I'm not sure that because I'm focusing on patients who are so close to the end of their lives and so in distress a lot of the time, whether I'm the ICU attending and they're, you know, on machines and their families are suffering and they have, or even when I'm the palliative care attending and I'm taking care of patients who are maybe more awake and able to talk to me. We generally talk about not so much about their regrets, which is interesting to me to think about this question. We talk more about how they want to live their lives until the end.
Okay, so from that point forward and rather than reflecting on the past.
Rather than reflecting on the past, which is interesting because I would think that that would be a conversation.
Can you have those type of conversations? Would that be an easy thing to have in that situation or necessary?
You know, it's funny. I think it would be a very helpful conversation for people to do a light, reflection on their life and what it has been, and how they feel about it. And actually, it's now many cases are starting to come to my mind. Of course, where I've had those types of conversations, but it's not the main focus of what we're doing there. Partly just honestly due to time constraints. I mean, I think that I would love to have that kind of luxury of time, but in a way, what I really am tasked with is number one, managing patients' symptoms and making sure that I'm mitigating any suffering that can be mitigated. And number two, really trying to guide the healthcare plan and the decisions that we make about how to manage that patient going forward towards their values and preferences, which is interesting. It's an interesting question.
Yeah, no, and I assume maybe the nurses are more sort of in there to have those conversations potentially as well.
Yes.
That someone in your position would be maybe. But yeah, no, I was just interested in perhaps any of the findings that you might be aware of.
That's interesting.
Very cool. Sounds like a great book and just want to encourage the guys to pick up a copy. I'll stick a link in the show notes. So if they want to go to thehiddenwhy.com, which is my website there, they can grab a copy through the Amazon link there. And you've also featured in or been a part of the documentary Extremis?
Yes. Extremis is a 24-minute short doc that is now streaming on Netflix, and it follows me and a couple of my patients and a colleague a colleague or two around the ICU at our hospital, and really focuses in a very cinema verite style on how we make decisions in the end, as people are so close to the end of life and how complex it is.
Okay, that sounds, and I love Netflix and I love documentaries, so it sounds like certainly a good one to watch as well. How did that come about? Was that, it wasn't in connection with the book, it was just an external documentary?
It was in connection with, I guess, with my zealotry about this topic. I had already been writing for a while about this topic, and I saw another film that happened to be made about the emergency room, about another topic, which was mostly about access to healthcare. And it was so, so powerful and so compelling. And it was made in our hospital. And I thought, oh my goodness, we need to have a film about the topic I'm so passionate about. And so I went after the director who had made this original film on about the emergency room. And I said, I have your next film for you. Come to our ICU. And he was too busy. And for the next year, I kept texting him every time I had an interesting conversation. Hey, this would have been amazing. Viewers would have found this so beneficial. And finally, he got tired of me texting him. And he said, look, I have this friend who's in between projects. And so he introduced me to Dan Krause. And Dan Krause came in, a wonderful filmmaker, and basically followed me around for about 3 months and made this just wonderful film.
Good on you. I like it.
It was nominated for an Academy Award. I mean, who ever knew? It really went further than we ever expected, and very exciting. Yeah, very proud of it.
So guys, check that out as well. I'll stick that in the show notes. I'm going to watch that as well. I just love the idea of the access of this sort of information that we have and in the form of documentaries, because we all like to watch the TV, and certainly it's a great way to share this information that we would otherwise not have access to. And you know, certainly reading articles and stuff on it can be sometimes a little bit monotonous or not time worthy. So people, certainly can benefit from this style of information.
Yeah, so, they say a picture's worth 1,000 words, and I think absolutely. A movie's worth 1,000 pictures.
Yeah, yeah. No, very cool stuff. I've got some quick questions to run through, Jessica, and then I'll let you on your way.
Sure.
You're a very busy lady, I'm sure, so we won't take you up too much longer of your time. First of all, have you got any routines or rituals that you believe contribute to your success?
Well, I mean, I wish I had more, but I do, we have a Shabbat dinner at our house every Friday night, and we always have lots of friends over and lots of singing. And there are many, many weeks where I've come home from the intensive care unit or from my job on the palliative care service and really felt such relief at having the space to process my thoughts and to reflect on what I've been doing and to readjust myself towards wanting to get to a certain goal, which is to do more education about this topic. So that's been very, very helpful to me.
So Friday night dinners.
Friday night dinners with friends and family.
Yeah, that's important. And what advice would you give your 20-year-old self?
Oh, wow. Get more sleep. Eat less licorice. No. I really think you have to figure out what you're good at and try to do that and not feel bad about the things that aren't as much of a strength. Stick with what you're good at and don't expect to be good at everything.
Okay. Yeah, that's important. And what's your meaning of success?
Well, for me, it's about having a lot of social, very positive social relationships around me and having a lot of goodwill and collaboration and friends and family and really feeling connected to people and feeling part of the web of humanity.
Hmm. Yeah. And I assume it's important in your role to have those good connections because I just can't imagine how stressful it must be. I couldn't do what you do.
Sometimes I wonder how I do it.
I said to it the other day, it came up in conversation about someone working in care, and I just thought I just would find it, because I'm such an emotional person, I'd find it so hard to handle that. But hey, good on you. What what is a piece of productivity advice you might give the audience that helps you in your day?
Well, for me, when I'm in the middle of something, I find it helpful, and I know a lot of people actually feel the opposite, so I don't know that it's the right thing for everybody, but I find it helpful to really get focused in on that one thing and just keep working on that one thing until you've kind of gotten it out of your system. So for me, that works. That may not work for everybody, but sort of getting hyper-focused and really getting into that topic and not letting it down until you've kind of finished it.
Till it's in bed, yep. No, it's a great way to go about things, I believe. And certainly good for everyone in what they're doing. What any advice you'd give to someone looking to make some change?
I think it's really, again, it comes back to that first thing I said about my 20-year-old self. I think it's really important to find out what it is that gives you passion and that you're good at. And I don't know that I know it completely in myself, but I think that, you know, there's a lot of people you can talk to, friends, family, and even a business coach to help you think through these things and find out what might be a place that you can use your wonderful skills to get to the goals that you personally care about.
Yeah, absolutely. And what is your favorite food? Licorice?
So funny. I did write that down when I just saw your questions. Twizzlers is what I wrote down, which I'm a little ashamed of, but I'm just trying to be honest.
Yeah.
Salt and vinegar potato chips too.
I used to be a fan of chilled salt and vinegar chips.
Oh, I've never had chilled. I'm going to have to try that.
To go in the fridge, yeah. What's your favorite leisure activity?
Oh, well, right. I have to say, I'm going to, unfortunately, over the past, I don't feel that I've been taking enough leisure. What I really enjoy doing is going with my daughter and our crazy poodle on a hike. That I love.
Cool. And a favorite book?
Oh, boy. I just read Middlesex, which I thought was amazing. And I love to read. I haven't read as much as I'd like over the past year. I'm going to have to start reading some more.
Middlesex, who's that by?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask me that.
That's all right. I'll look it up.
Fantastic book. Fantastic book.
Okay. And have you got a quote that you'd like to say?
Well, I have two quotes that are at the front of my book that I found very meaningful. One is, the good physician takes care of the patient, but the good physician takes care of the disease and the great physician takes care of the patient, which is from Osler, a great, I just think that's an important quote.
Mm-hmm. And the other one?
The other one is, oh my goodness, this is terrible. Well, here's one that, this is actually something that I wrote in my book, which I quote a lot, which is, you can't plan for a good death if you don't know you're dying. That's actually me, and I don't think I'm really quotable, but nonetheless, that's the one that jumps to my mind right now.
Everyone's quotable. you can't plan a good death if you don't know you're dying yet, which leaves me with another question is how, what, you know, what can you give us to sort of walk away with? You know, I'm not dying as far as I know. I guess we're all dying, aren't we? But what sort of can you leave with us to help us in this stage, even before we've, you know, ever been diagnosed or perhaps we're way off that stage, to help us start thinking about death and dying?
You know, I would say the thing that's most that I think is most reassuring in this work and in this path that we all have to walk about processing our own death is the human spirit is so resilient. We are shockingly able to overcome so much pain. And, you know, sometimes we have to walk through it to get to the other side. And I think that's the same thing about accepting and acknowledging death, that if you start to bring it in to your conversation, you kind of move past that pain and that grief, even when you're, again, if you're not sick, and you can move into being more of a planning and forward thinking person. So I say, acknowledge it, talk about it, bring it into your life, bring it into your conversations.
Yeah. So just get over that initial sort of fear of it all. Cool. Yeah. Good advice. Do you believe we all have a why, a purpose?
Definitely. And I mean, I have taken care of so many people. And I have been moved by so many people. And it doesn't matter if it's a homeless person who's not educated or if it's an executive at Charles Schwab. Human beings are amazing. And one of the biggest privileges of my life is that I get to meet so many different kinds of people and to learn and be moved by them, no matter who they are. And I'm moved by almost many of them, most of them, in a very powerful way.
Yeah, that's really, quite refreshing. And I agree. I mean, I love to talk to people because I believe everyone that we interact with daily, we can take away something from and learn something from. But as it relates to the why, it just, you know, it spreads a really powerful message that, you know, everyone has something that they can give, and we just have to sort of, you know, do the searching, find that and keep going after it, trying to discover it. And then, you know, once we do, we can, I think, live a greater journey till the end.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And what does living life with passion and purpose mean to you?
It means feeling that you have principles and really reflecting on them with some frequency so that you can calibrate yourself and calibrate your actions and keep coming back to that set of things that are really important to you. And if you can stay in there somewhat, and not stray too far from it, and keep that ability to look at things, and just like we looking at death, but also to look at yourself and your own personal principles, and you feel that you're staying reasonably on track, that to me is living a life of real purpose.
Yeah, absolutely. So finding those guiding principles of your life and really, you know, staying as close to them as you can. Looks like we've lost Jessica there just at the end, but we did have a fantastic... Hello, Jessica.
Here.
There you are. Sorry. I was just about to wrap it up. There, you're back. Okay, so look, that's really powerful stuff, Jessica. I really appreciate you coming on the show today, and thank you for sharing your message. I'll stick all the links in the show notes, guys, so if you want to reach out to Jessica, I'll stick her link in there as well. Jessica, is the best way to reach you your website, jessicazitter.com?
Yes, that is the best way to go.
Cool. Are you on Twitter, Facebook, any preferred social media channels or anything like that?
Twitter and Facebook. I wish I knew how to use Instagram.
Yeah, I don't know if you need to. Just all too much. But look, yeah, reach out, guys, to Jessica. Thank you for coming on the show. If you want to find out more information about what she's doing and her work, that would be great. Jessica, it's been a very unique discussion, actually, here at The Hidden Why. I appreciate the new insight that I've gained from it as well.
Oh, wonderful. Such a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and all the best with your future work too.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Guys, check it all out at thehiddenwhy.com. Make sure you're subscribed to the podcast and our newsletter as well. And we will talk to you soon. Until next time, peace, passion, and purpose. Bye for now. There you go, guys. I hope you've enjoyed today's show. Please reach out to me if you have any questions, thoughts, or feedback for the show as well. I would love to hear from you. Guys, this show is sponsored by MotionWrapped.com. If you have a brand, a business, product, event, or creative independent work that you want to promote, but you have a tight budget to do it, then MotionWrapped.com might be your solution. MotionWrapped specializes in video and motion graphics, graphic design, social marketing for independent creatives and entrepreneurs. They can cover all your product or brand's foundational needs, whether it be a logo design, a complete brand identity, the promotion of a product or event, images and videos for social media, or promotional assets via print and video. And best of all, they strategically tailor the development process to suit your budget and to suit your needs. Just because something is cheap and simple doesn't mean it still can't have great effect. And that's certainly the work that MotionWrapped does. If you'd like more information on developing an effective promotional marketing strategy for your startup or independent creative work, visit www.motionwrapped.com and discuss what can be done. That's www.motionwrapped.com. We are also sponsored by Global Office Assistance, a great outsourcing solution. So if you're, again, an entrepreneur, a creative, independent, looking to free up some of your time and outsource or delegate out a lot of those admin tasks, those systems and processes you have in place that just chew up a lot of your time that you don't necessarily need to be doing, virtual assistants are a great way to do that. I've just written a book about this as well called Delegate to Freedom. So if you're interested, I'm happy to send you a copy for free. Just email me at thehiddenwhyguy@gmail.com. But more importantly, if you're interested or have thought about hiring someone to help you in your business, virtual assistants are a very affordable way to do that. Our team is based in the Philippines, so you can get a great assistant for a very affordable price, and their work quality is just as good as anyone else that you could otherwise hire. So check it out, globaloffice.com. That's globaloffice.com. You can set up a time to consult with them and they can discuss your needs further and see if it's a fit for you. Guys, that's it from me here at The Hidden Why. I hope you enjoy your day. I hope you enjoy your week. And until next time, peace, passion, and purpose. We'll see you soon.